The Claire Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Now, you're welcome to the debrief. We're going to look back on some of the biggest stories of the week. And today I'm joined by the political editor of the Irish Independent, Mary Regan, columnist and author, Carl Kinsella, and editor of the journal, Sinead O'Carroll. And you're all really welcome to the show. But before we get started with our chat, I want to play some clips for you, because Bertie Ahern's recent comments on immigration have garnered a lot of criticism and attention in the last couple of days. He's now reflected on that video that went viral, and he's been talking about it in an interview with the Irish Independent's Kevin Doyle on the Indo Daily podcast. Bertie Ahern says he doesn't accept the claim that he is a racist.
I used to be accused of bringing in too many, both Europeans and others. So I think integration matters. Communities work best when people feel included, supported and connected to Irish society and culture. And I totally subscribe to that. And the balance is important for both new arrivals and the communities that are welcoming them. So I know. So looking back, just to be clear, Kevin, my wording in an informal conversation was not careful or polished. wasn't, and would have been if I was doing a formal interview or public address. So if anyone was offended by how I expressed myself, I sincerely regret that. But I do not accept the claim that I'm racist, because that's just simply not true.
And in that conversation with Kevin Doyle, Bertie Ahern went on to admit that he shouldn't have singled out a particular nationality, but he said the reaction to what he said has been a sad day for free speech.
It's very annoying because, you know, the last thing, I mean, if...
But do you understand why those headlines arrived, I suppose?
I don't actually. I don't take that my comments, you know, could be said. I certainly have no difficulty agreeing to the point that I shouldn't have singled out one nationality. That was wrong. But I don't think that there's anything wrong with talking about what the people are talking about. If we come to a stage in this country you mention an issue people are talking about and you're jumped on, well, that's a sad day for speech.
One more bit we wanted to bring you. He said he was unhappy with the Irish imam, Dr. Umar Al-Qadri's comments about the video. Bertie Ahern said he had stood on his head trying to help the Muslim community.
If our integration system that I set up is working and if it's effective enough, fine. I don't know whether it is or not. I hope it is. And if the imam wants to come and talk to me, even though I have no influence politically now, I'd be glad to discuss it with him. But I think for him to say that I was in some way out of touch or I didn't know about this, when I've stood on my head to try and help them in the early years here and help them in Clonskee and visit Clonskee and help them when they were under duress from after the difficulties in the United States, I think is a bit rich.
Okay, that is Bertie Ahern speaking to Kevin Doyle on the Indo Daily podcast. What do we think of that, panellists? Mary, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think Bertie Ahern is clearly shaken and upset by the controversy, but also very defiant. He's not apologising. And yes, he accepts, you know, that singling out a particular nationality was not the way to go about it. But it's interesting now because Jack Chambers has very strongly criticised Bertie Ahern's comments, saying they were totally wrong and inappropriate and not reflecting my party's values, is how he put it. While you have Jim O'Callaghan, on the other hand, defending Bertie Ahern to a degree. He also did an interview with us for Indo-Politics yesterday, and he said, you know, while the comments were inappropriate and inadvisable to single out certain nationalities, I don't think Bertie Ahern is a racist, he said. And then he went on to describe how Bertie Ahern had done a lot of work in this country to stop sectarianism, you know, how he reached out to both communities in the north, and that he's not a racist person by any means. So you have this sort of difference of opinion within Fianna Fáil itself, mm-hmm. ahead of what was to be the party's very big celebration occasion, 100 years old tomorrow, 100 years since the party first met, and also marking its ardesh. And it hasn't been in a good place for some time, and Fianna Fáil is not in a good place this weekend.
And do you think, given the conversations that you've had this week, I mean, you said Bertie Hearn sounds shook there and upset by it. Mm. Is the party shook this week?
I think at first there was an element of, this isn't the party, this is Bertie Ahern, and, you know, he was recorded secretly. So, and there was also an element of, you know, the thing that Bertie Ahern was always great at was telling people what they wanted to hear. Whoever he was chatting to, he made them feel always that he was agreeing with them.
You wrote a column about
this. Yeah, and
this,
that it was
week.
His great political skill in many respects. And there was an element of maybe giving him a pass because they thought that's kind of what he was doing. But listening to him this lunchtime in that interview with Kevin Doyle, you know, Bertie Ahern, you know, is defined about what he said. So he's not backing away to a huge amount about what he was saying. Mm, okay. So it points to this sort of bigger issue and a sort of elephant in the room in Irish politics, which Jim O'Callaghan was talking to us about, which is that people in Ireland really want to talk about migration. They really have concerns and issues, but they don't really know how to talk about it. And they don't know how to address their concerns in a way that might be seen to be giving sucker in some way, you know, to the far right, uh-huh. or to come across in a racist manner.
It's classic behaviour of someone who's been caught out. And instead of thinking about the thing that they've been caught out in, they're trying to get themselves personally out of it. Like the idea that he's saying that, like, he thinks people from other communities should be included, supported and connected. Whereas the entire news agenda today is talking about his comments. If you're someone with Central African heritage or who has come here from Central Africa, or you're a Muslim, like, I don't think any of those people today, as we're debating what is and isn't racist about singling out people from a certain country and being told that the former Taoiseach is worried about you, worried about the next generation of your people, and also that we are taking in too many of you. I don't think you feel included, connected or supported, so no matter what.
You would have expected an apology, Sinead.
Yeah, well, I think, and especially saying things like, I went out of my way to be nice to the Muslim community. That, again, doesn't portray inclusive thinking about people who are not white or Irish. It feels like it's more of the same that was said in the covert video.
I think if there was an apology, it would have drawn a line under the issue ahead of the Fianna Fáil ardesh starting this evening. But the fact that there wasn't, the debate continues and the discussion and the controversy rolls on into the weekend.
Carl, what do you feel about what you heard from Bertie Ahern there in those clips?
Well, I think his defiance is illuminating in the sense that he doesn't seem to have, as Sinead sort of alluded to, he doesn't seem to have reflected with any great level of empathy for the people who his comments might have offended. You know, you kind of get that classic faux apology style of, you know, if anyone was offended by my remarks, you know, then I'm sorry. But at the end of the day, people are inevitably going to be offended by language like that. If you're drawing a line, and it's really interesting that he said that he never intended to single anyone out, or that it was a mistake to single out a certain group. Because in actual fact, if you listen to the substance of the recording, that's the very intention of what he's doing. He actually draws a line of demarcation between, for example, Ukrainians, who he says he is happy for them to be here, but people from, you know, to use his words, places like the Congo. And he did kind of go further. He said places like those, which also I think it's worth examining what he means by that.
He did make reference to the Russian invasion, though, because I don't want people to think that he, for any other reason, he singled out the Ukrainians, because I don't know that that's why he
did that.
And then we know that there are conflicts in other parts of the world, but he did make reference to the war in Ukraine. What about the issue of people being secretly filmed, secretly recorded, Carl? Do you have an issue with that?
I think certainly in principle and in theory, it is, you know, always wrong to be recording someone without their permission, or, you know, wrong in 99.9% of cases. I do think that Bertie's excuse that it was a case of, you know, a lack of polish is kind of misleading, particularly when he then goes on to say that people should be allowed to speak freely when it comes to matters of migration, because it's sort of like, well, were you speaking uncarefully or were you speaking freely? Because if he was speaking freely, then it's much harder for him to distance himself from the remarks.
I think that goes to the heart of the wider conversation. So the tone of the conversation around migration has changed for multiple reasons since the riots in November 23, and the fact that the state wasn't ready to take in people, and we had tents kind of parked outside and the centres on Mount Street and down the canal. But one of the ways that politicians never talk about migration is why it's happening and what place we have and the wider European Union has in that. Like, if you look at the moment at what's happening in Lebanon, which is home to some of the biggest refugee camps for Palestinians, like, because Israel is acting with impunity in Lebanon and continues to bomb without the European Union saying one word about it, the latest figures that I could find this morning, in April, UN had recorded 5,391 displaced families that had moved into the already existing Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. Like, if the European Union is on one hand saying we have to deal with the number of people who are coming to Europe because we feel it is too many people, but at the same time, when conflicts that they have ability to impact, a change, stop, or even say anything about, they continue to ignore. Yeah. And then that's where the thousands of people looking for shelter and refugee, like the idea of...
I think people would take that point. But what about what Mary said, that people in Ireland want to talk about this, but they don't know how and are often afraid to talk about it?
But from everything that I've heard over the airways and online over the last 3 years, the conversation is continuing. It has changed massively since before COVID. We were talking about how to improve the asylum seeking system, how to improve direct provision. Now the entire conversation has changed to how do we block, how do we stop, how do we make it less friendly for people. That conversation is happening consistently.
Yeah, there was also
constantly.
Yeah, and there was a study by the ESRI research that came out in January that said that negative attitudes towards immigration in Ireland are very much being stoked by an overestimation of how many immigrants are actually coming to Ireland. So I think if we want to have an honest conversation about it, we can, but we need to actually look at those realities and look at the fact that people are being misled and that there is a narrative around migration in Ireland that is overtly negative. And you've even had politicians like Simon Harris in the last year who have said that maybe we do have too many numbers coming in. And I think it needs to be looked at that, you know, I think that it is a very mainstreamed view at this point. There is a lot of negativity in the mainstream around immigration to Ireland. So I don't necessarily agree that people don't know how to talk about it. I certainly feel like people are talking about it all the time. I think people speak very freely about it. They speak very aggressively about it. I don't feel like I can even avoid those conversations.
I think it's the people who might be seen as being more aggressive or more right-wing or, you know, even racist in their views are the voices that are coming through the loudest, where as the point is that people who, like, one concern that I'm hearing from a lot of TDs is the 1 billion spend last year on IPASS. 1 billion a year on IPASS accommodation is really rankling with voters, according to a number of TDs, who may not have had too many issues with migration before. But the fact that we're now in a cost of living crisis and people are really struggling and they're seeing this 1 billion spend, that is an issue. And, you know, Jim O'Callaghan is saying that a significant majority of people, he says, coming to Ireland aren't actually fleeing war. He says they are here because there are economic opportunities for them in Ireland. And that is the Justice Minister saying that. And he's saying, you know, there are people coming and they're not entitled to asylum. And yes, they're entitled to claim asylum, but they're not entitled to necessarily get asylum. And he's saying that's based on figures that 5,500 people who had their asylum applications adjudicated this year, 83 were rejected. So he is saying that there are a lot of people coming here who aren't entitled to asylum, and he wants to sort of bring down those numbers.
It's interesting because that spend, that billion spend, I don't think anybody thinks that is money well spent, given the accommodation standards that people who come here and are waiting for decisions.
A lot of it going to private providers.
And a lot of it's going for private providers. Well, and again, like, that has been covered by most outlets about, like, who's making the money, how it's been made, what the standards, like, we've done loads of reporting on in the journal. So it's none of that is being silenced. It's the framing of it. Like, whose fault is it that we're overspending and lining the pockets of private providers with that much money? It's the same as many other controversies in that we are incredibly bad at everyday spending and budgeting in this country.
I'm going to move on from that topic because we have a lot to get through. And we had a great conversation, a lively conversation this week about the infrastructure that's happening in and around the Ryder Cup, which is coming in September of 2027. So it's a temporary train station happening in Adair. There's also going to be the bypass in Adair. They're waiting for it for 20 years and suddenly it's going to be done. by September. And some feel, you know, people in Galway waiting for the Ring Road, people waiting for the Navan to Dublin rail link, that things can be done very, very quickly when there's a big golf competition coming. Are they right, Carl, to think that?
Well, it certainly seems to be almost self-evident on the basis of this latest development. And actually, I heard Minister Niall Collins on your programme during this week. And it is funny, that sort of almost contradiction of saying that, oh, it's been, the phrase he used was shovel ready for 40 years. And he was almost saying that, well, that's why it's legitimate for it to go ahead now. And of course, it's legitimate. It's a very legitimate project. But the idea that the catalyst for it actually being brought to fruition is, of course, the Ryder Cup. If the Ryder Cup was not happening, we were presumably going 41 years shovel ready, 42 years shovel ready. So I think it is a real cause of frustration for people around the country when they see that the political will can manifest almost out of nowhere when you have, you know, an economic boon on the line, or you might have Donald Trump visiting, or whatever other benefits we feel we might get. I think, honestly, when you look at that kind of logic, you start to wonder, is the real incentive here that we just don't want to embarrass ourselves in front of an international audience, and so we need to have the infrastructure in place? But for whatever reason, those incentives don't seem to apply to, as you say, other transport infrastructure projects, or you even could talk about housing or talk about healthcare, all the things that we struggle.
Well, it just
build.
Shows what can be done in the time frame, right?
My podcast colleague Gav Cooney, we do a podcast on sport and news, and his argument is always, if there's an economic report on sport plus Americans in view, then we will do absolutely everything we can to make sure it works. Like, there is a steering group, and since we kind of got word that this steering group, a cross-department steering group, was being put together to ensure that the Ryder Cup would be a success. Great idea. Excellent idea. Knock the best heads together, the people who have decision-making power. But remember when Owen Murphy did his book tour last year, and he said he wanted a cross-department buy-in for how to fix housing, and he couldn't get it because no one wanted to own it, because, you know, it's not as sexy as the Ryder Cup and also way more problematic. Mm-hmm. So it's not wrong that it's being done for this. And
except now we're supposed to have a whole of government push on infrastructure. Isn't that what we're all about at the moment?
Yeah, and the Critical Infrastructure Bill is aimed at addressing this, getting critical pieces, you know, done without too many objections, without too much interference. But the problem with it is, you know, we don't really know what defines critical infrastructure. So one man's piece of critical infrastructure, like, for example, the Adair bypass, could be another man's parish pump.
Train station in Patrick's Well is essential, well, according to Niall Collins.
I think for the bypass in Adair, I don't think, okay, yeah, we love, you know, scrubbing up and putting on a good show for the Yanks. No one, I don't think, can disagree with a
it's
bypass
needed.
For
of course
Adair.
It is.
It is the worst, one of the worst spots in the country.
But as Carl said, there's loads of things
through.
That are just as necessary around the country, mm-hmm. and they're waiting decades for stuff. And then when you see Rory bringing his friends in for the Ryder Cup, the thing is done really quickly. Mm. It sticks in your craw
a
bit.
And it does show how, you know, the right will, things can be done quickly. But this piece of critical infrastructure bill, you know, it's very hard to determine, you know, who exactly and how exactly things will be decided and determined as critical infrastructure. Will any private projects, for example, be deemed critical infrastructure? We know that wind farms that are private, are offshore wind, privately operated, and are going to be deemed critical infrastructure. So that could that apply, for example, the question was raised in the Dáil this week, to data centres? You know, we don't know really if that's going to be the case yet or not. And I guess it all goes back to the whole issue of transparency in this country, and, you know, whether those who demand and shout loudest and have the most access to power and get what they need.
It's not just the government. Like, the Ryder Cup has looked at the GAA and said, would you change the Hurling League final to September, despite us having, again, a constant discussion about how the split season now is
they
like...
They can scat out of it now. That's a step too far. Listen, I got in loads of trouble this week for saying that I wasn't averse to kicking a dog poo into a bush if I felt that nobody was going to tread in it. This was on the back of the fines increasing for allowing your dog to foul a pavement, going from 150 to 250. Will it make any difference, Carl?
No, I feel like we have the data on this, don't we? That something like in the last year, I'm not sure if this was, I think it's nationwide, but it's some
48.
It's 48.
Yeah, 48 you know, prosecutions
or prosecutions issued for dog fouling. So ultimately, I think I saw, you know, this morning that the city of Limerick has two dog wardens. You know, so ultimately, to even call that a band-aid solution would be very generous. It's really like,
but there's no doubt about it. It is a really big problem on the streets.
Such a huge problem. If you live in a urban centre, like I've lived in the city centre for And I have also had a buggy for the last 4 years.
And you come in through your front door and you look down. What is that smell, you think?
And it's on the buggy and it's impossible to get off the buggy. But we have now trained our four-year-old. So if she saw you kick that poo into the bush, she would look up at you and say, bad owner. Because we make sure that she doesn't blame the dog. It's not the dog's fault.
No, it's not the dog's fault. It is the owner's fault. But the thing about kicking it into the bush is the biodegradable bags also take years to biodegrade, right? So is it not better to Hi, I'm not talking about a place. Mary, you're looking at me so skeptically.
But if you put it in a place where on the issue of dog crap. Yeah, I mean, you know, like Sinead, it's an obstacle course for any parent walking.
But I'm not saying leave it on the pavement.
Okay. Well,
never
if it's
do
gone,
that.
I don't care where it's gone to be honest, so long as it's not on the path.
Okay, yeah.
And it is an obstacle course walking kids home from school or creche, especially if, like, buggies was one thing that I recall. Scooters is, and you'd see the kids like try and swerve. And any dog owner you talk to claim to be angelic in terms of like picking up the dog crap on the street. So I don't know where it's all coming from or why, but it's always
dogs
there. But we don't have dog wardens in this country, and there has been like...
Well, we do. We don't have enough of them.
But we don't... we don't have enough of them, and nothing seems to be...
We could never have enough of them, could we?
It's not just that. It's dogs. This is another, pet issue of mine. Excuse the pun. Dogs off the leash in parks, on the beach. And again, the owners are like, oh, he's grand. She won't touch you. They're lovely and friendly. Okay, they might be friendly, but still your child might not necessarily feel comfortable playing on the sand, playing on the park.
A dog one day ate my child's entire meatball dinner in the park.
And look,
2 years on, she still remembers it. It could have ruined her relationship with dogs forever.
Mary, you don't like dogs.
I love dogs. I had a number of dogs. You know, we grew up in the country, so we had lots of dogs growing up. Lovely dogs, you know, and I you know, had such strong bonds and memories. And, you know, even as an adult, I had dogs. Don't have one at the moment. So I do like dogs, but I think there is a responsible way to own dogs.
Yeah.
And I think
it's like children.
You can see
them if they're my own.
Yeah. like humans in general, like we like certain ones, but not all of them. But I mean, it's the responsible dog ownership, you know, I think is sort of, I think Irish people have sort of lost an understanding of how to own dogs how to have dogs responsibly.
I think they should give us all citizen arrest powers. So like not arrest, but like we should be able to hand out the fines somehow. Yeah, you know,
more
if you
anarchy.
See someone do it, like I don't mind if I'm the terrible person who does it. Like I will be the rat.
Our time is up. Thank you so much for coming in to Mary, Sinead and to Carl.
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.